From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke and Bob are away this week. I'm Mike Pesca. Inside Baghdad's heavily fortified international zone this week, the Iraqi government inched closer to a constitutional democracy as a political convention settled on the makeup of an interim parliament. Though those negotiations were tense, they were overshadowed by even greater tension in the southern city of Najaf. U.S. and Iraqi forces there faced off against followers of Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, who were holed up in the Imam Ali Shrine, one of Shia Islam's most sacred sites. The news of the fighting was full of ultimatums, tentative truces, and aerial bombardment, reflecting the general fog of war. While al-Sadr's tactics are vexing, his motivations are well known, but still he tends to be treated as an international man of mystery. Here's an AP story from Thursday. What's clear about radical Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr is he wants power, U.S. officials say. What's less certain is what he wants to do with that power, or how far he'll go to get it. As the U.S. government struggles to understand al-Sadr and his motives, that uncertainty is complicating efforts to end one of the greatest threats to stability in Iraq. But what's truly puzzling, according to University of Michigan history professor and blogger Juan Cole, is the aura of inscrutability that surrounds Muqtada al-Sadr.
If they're confused, they're not paying attention. In terms of overall questions of what he wants, what he envisages for the future, I think he's been very clear and very consistent. He wants the United States out of Iraq now, immediately. He considers the country to be occupied. He considers the occupation to be illegitimate. Beyond that, he would like an Islamic State in Iraq, probably somewhat similar to what exists in Iran, but independent of Iran and under Iraqi Shiite control.
So if the government does and should understand what he wants, does the coverage of Muqtada al-Sadr reflect an understanding on the part of U.S. journalists?
On the whole, I think they probably don't much understand him or where he's coming from. The fact is most U.S. journalists who are covering Iraq don't know Arabic. Many of them don't have a long experience in looking at the country, and they don't tend to cover major speeches that people like Muqtada give. For instance, in the middle of August, Muqtada al-Sadr gave a two-hour interview in Al Jazeera, and I didn't see any reporting coming out of that in the Western press at all.
And now I'm going to ask you a military question, but it actually leads to a media question. And the question is, in your blog, juancole.com, you write that you don't see why the U.S. had to press the issue against Muqtada al-Sadr and his followers right now.
That's correct. In my view, if his militia was a problem, it was a problem out in those Shiite cities, Kut, Amara, wherever they were. And if they were a problem, then they should have been dealt with there on the streets of Kut. Instead, the Americans in April suddenly announced that they wanted to kill or capture Muqtada al-Sadr. He had given strict instructions to his people not to tangle with the American troops, and there were no incidents to speak of until April. And before that, he was, a relatively minor figure in national terms. But by attempting to kill or capture him, they impelled him to then launch an insurgency, I think, to make the point that he wasn't going to go quietly. And then his popularity soared so that one opinion poll in May found that 68% of Iraqis had a favorable opinion of him. And I think it's probably gone up again this month.
Now here's the media question. Is the Western media, who in Iraq is unsafe, unable to speak the language, unable to defy their protectors, the U.S. military, are they not sufficiently asking the very question that you were asking, why go after Muqtada al-Sadr now?
Well, it's the kind of question that is difficult for the press to ask. For one thing, if they did ask the U.S. officials or the Iraqi interim government, they probably would just get stonewalled. But I would say that there is a tendency in the American press generally to follow the lead of the Bush administration policy spokespersons. And so the Bush administration maintains that Muqtada al-Sadr is a danger to Iraqi political and civil society, must be dealt with. That tends to then set the tone for the stories that follow. Although there are notable exceptions, for instance, this week, John Burns and Alex Berenson of the New York Times did an extremely important story on how the fighting began in Najaf. The story they put together is that this was a local initiative by local Marine commanders and the local U.S.-appointed governor of Najaf, and then it presented the higher-ups with a kind of fait accompli, you know, because then people on up the chain of command would have to say, well, okay, we're going to pull the Marines back, and that's a difficult thing to do in these kinds of situations. And so then the United States is in a position of assaulting Najaf, which is a holy city to Muslims around the world. I've seen person-on-the-street interviews on Arab satellite television in Egypt, for instance, where people were saying, this is an American attack on Islam.
And is the Arab press or Arab television like Al Jazeera emphasizing this aspect of the fight?
Oh, yes, absolutely. But they don't have to play it up very much because it's already there in the Arab and Muslim publics. Within Najaf, things look different. You know, the people of Najaf don't like the Mahdi militia. They want to get rid of them. And they may even be grateful to the Marines for this fighting. But the farther away you get from Najaf, even within Iraq among Shiites, the worse it looks. And then if you get outside Iraq, it looks just completely horrible. So it's a public relations disaster for the United States, no matter how it turns out.
Thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Juan Cole is a professor of history at the University of Michigan, and his blog is juancole.com.
Gold medal as much as I want to mother a child. That is Svetlana Horkina. She loves the attention. We're going to miss her, and she's going to miss this.
The Super Bowl is to sports as the Olympics are to, well, it should also be sports. But the Olympics look like a sporting event. If you get close enough, they smell like a sporting event, and they frequently involve pulled groins. But still, there's something about the Olympics which just doesn't feel like sport. Neil Pilson, now a sports media consultant, oversaw several Olympics when he was president of CBS Sports in the 1990s.
The Olympics are probably closer to being an entertainment property than a sports property. And as an entertainment property, you are looking for that much broader audience.
The Olympics simply don't work like other sporting events as we experience them. That is to say, they're not debated on sports talk radio. The highlights aren't shown endlessly on ESPN, and because of time delays, it's pretty hard not to know who won beforehand. 75% of the people who watch most TV sports are men. 60% of Olympics viewers are women. As a result, while the Olympics make a lot of money for NBC and draw on all sorts of non-traditional sports fans, they turn out not to be especially appealing to the foam-finger-waving, statistic-devouring, season-ticket-holding, typical American fan.
Although, yeah, I'm rooting for the United States to do well in the Olympics. I'm just not as interested, really.
It all depends on what's on against it. If it's a baseball game and the Yankees are on, I'd rather watch that than the Olympics.
Jim Jackson from Massachusetts and Scott Ziegler from Pittsburgh were busy shopping this week at the Yankees team store in Midtown Manhattan. If anyone should be watching the biggest televised sporting event of the summer on TV, it's these two men, huge fans of football and baseball. But they're not watching much. Neither is WFAN's Mike Francesa, co-host of the most popular local sports radio show in America. By all rights, he should love the Olympics. He vividly remembers Sugar Ray Leonard and the Spinks brothers winning gold in Montreal in 76. But these days...
If I didn't watch 1 minute of the Olympics, I would not feel cheated. I really wouldn't.
For one thing, Francesa says in prime time, NBC doesn't play the sports he likes. Boxing, basketball, synchronized swimming. Just kidding about the last one. Also, Francesa and others like him are more outcome-oriented than your typical Olympics viewer.
The taped aspect is very difficult for the regular sports fan. There's nothing a sports fan hates more is to get a result and then watch an event.
But NBC statistics show that ratings actually go up for taped events if the news of an American victory gets out beforehand. In other words, the same thing that drives traditional fans crazy drives Olympic fans to the TV. And Olympic fans is the right phrase, according to former sports exec Neil Pilson. He points to a sport like beach volleyball, which gets a 1 rating normally. But during the Olympics, it gets a 5 or 6. And in prime time, beach volleyball gets a rating of 16 to 18.
The American public is interested in the Olympics and not necessarily in specific sports.
What's great for NBC is death for other outlets trying to cover the Olympics. Because NBC paid over $750 million for the rights to these games, the Olympic Committee imposes strict limits on anyone else who wants to use footage. As a result, even though producer David Borofsky makes sure the Olympics are well covered on his network, ESPN, there's a high degree of difficulty.
We can't show footage until after 3 a.m. on any one given day. We can only show it for 24 hours.
It's a video medium, you know, with television. So not having the moving pictures, I mean, to me, it's always a bit ridiculous to have to show still photos. That I don't like to do. So, yeah, I don't put as much into it as we probably would.
Chris Raggi does the 6 and 11 o'clock sportscast on WCBS in New York. Things are a lot different at CBS compared to his old job at NBC.
If you're with the Rights Fees Network, it's heaven on earth. If you're not, or even if you're with an affiliate, forget about it. You'd rather be dragged over hot coals.
As for the viewer, the Olympic Games often become a little like the biathlon. First, it's a test of endurance. You carefully avoid radio, internet, and random snatches of conversation which mention who won. Later, the exact opposite. You concentrate steadily, knowing if your attention is drawn from NBC for a moment, you won't be able to watch highlights anywhere else. Of course, the alternative would be a little jarring. Imagine ESPN Equestrian Tonight analyzing game film of the New Zealand rider totally blowing her trot half pass. For a little over 2 weeks every 4 years, the sports world and the TV sports world become a little unfamiliar. But eventually, badminton goes back to being something you play at a barbecue, and the Indians are a team from Cleveland, not the silver medalists in the men's double trap. Next, one journalist who refused to chase down rumors, use anonymous sources, or let anyone go off the record. He wasn't fired. In fact, he's now remembered as one of the greats of the profession. You can listen to On the Media online and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Mike Pesca. On Wednesday, reporters who covered Wenho Li, the American scientist falsely accused of spying for China, were fined by a federal judge for not revealing who their sources were. A week earlier, Time magazine reporter Matthew Cooper was ordered to jail for not revealing who leaked the identity of CIA operative Valerie Plame. Cooper's now free pending appeal. News organizations have decried the tactics of prosecutors who are compelling reporters to give up their sources. We know what the prosecutors and judges think about all this, but what do the leakers think? Daniel Ellsberg is among American journalism's most famous leakers. He brought the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times and 19 other newspapers in 1971. Daniel Ellsberg, welcome to On the Media.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Do you think any of these reporters should be giving up their source?
No. If they did, in fact, promise confidentiality, I think they should defend that privilege and take it up to the Supreme Court if necessary. The ruling that there is no journalistic privilege, the Brandsburg versus Hayes ruling in 1972, is very questionable and it deserves to be reconsidered.
Do you think there should be a general reporter shield?
Yes.
How much should the shield depend on the nature of the information that was leaked?
Well, circumstances do differ here. We have, in the case of the leak of Valerie Plame's name and some other cases I could mention, what I would say are genuinely dangerous, damaging leaks, hurting our national security far beyond any public interest that's served by putting out that information. And those leaks were made, of course, it seems, at the very highest level. They also violate laws. There is a law against putting out the identity of an intelligence operative. And I don't oppose that law. The fact is there is a law, and it is legal at this point for the prosecutor to be subpoenaing these reporters. He certainly is within his legal right. And that warns us, by the way, of what we should expect if we get a broad Official Secrets Act, which we don't have, that criminalizes all leaks. We do have laws that criminalize leaks of intelligence identities or communications intelligence or nuclear weapons data. And I, as somebody who was a source of classified information, and do believe that my leak, my revelation was very much in the public interest, I'm not against those narrow laws, which I didn't violate, as it happens. So in this case, we have the question then of whether the source of the leak should be subject to prosecution, and I would say that they should.
And if any of the journalists in the Plame case were indeed compelled, or if they just felt that they should identify their sources, do you think that that would have a chilling effect on all of leaking and all of journalism, or just reflect poorly upon their ability to get future leaks?
If they gave in to the legal process here that confronts him with jail, if they don't reveal, that certainly would have a chilling effect generally. This is not a simple ethical question. I don't say there is a simple rule for this. Here is one aspect of this people I think are missing. Reporters who did not give a confidentiality pledge to a particular source are certainly not bound by another reporter's pledge. And if there are reporters, and I'm sure there are, who do know the identity of those sources, the people who violated that good law here in this case, or who can find it out, they should be investigating that, who endangered our security, and they should print it.
As a leaker, I'm going to assume that if a reporter gave up his source, for instance, if Matthew Cooper gave up his source, you as a leaker would never, ever turn to him.
No, pardon me. The idea that an absolute promise is essential where the leak involves saving lives, where the leak involves major issues of life and death and avoiding a war, ending a war, absolute confidentiality, thus protecting the source, should not be the sole requirement. And it was not for me. As somebody who was prosecuted for a leak, I can say certainly that I expected to be prosecuted. And by the way, I never demanded absolute confidentiality, and of course, I didn't get it. I would like to see more such leaks. In fact, I would like to see people right now who believe that there are documents that show lies. People should, at risk to themselves, consider doing what I wish I'd done much earlier, and that is going to the press with documents and revealing those. And I very much applaud the person who did give the Taguba report, without which we would not yet know of the abuses in Abu Ghraib and elsewhere, and there'd be no chance of changing them.
Daniel Ellsberg, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Daniel Ellsberg is the author of Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers. 15 years ago this summer, American journalism lost one of its greatest practitioners, Isidore Feinstein Stone, byline I.F. Stone, known to friends as Izzy. Stone worked at papers large and small in the 1930s. He was the Washington editor of The Nation magazine in the 40s, and in 1953, out of a job and with his name on a Senate list of typical sponsors of communist front organizations, he launched I.F. Stone's Weekly right out of his house. Before long, what was called a highly personal, radical publication established itself as a must-read for Washington insiders. On the Media's Megan Ryan looks back at the work of I.F. Stone.
This summer, as news organizations reconsider their coverage in the run-up to war, I.F. Stone's reporting offers an object lesson. According to Victor Navasky, now publisher of The Nation, Stone's M.O. was different from any other Washington correspondent.
He declined to go to any off-the-record briefing, and he'd hang out outside, and then he talked to the people who heard it, and he wasn't bound by any off-the-record rules. He wouldn't accept what they told him. He then would go and check it out. He got scoop after scoop that way, and they were the opposite of insider journalism. They were kind of an outsider's putting things in context.
I.F. Stone says, don't go to anybody's house, don't become friends with anybody, don't become a captive of your sources.
That was his advice to Jack Newfield, author and longtime columnist for The Village Voice.
You don't need these big shots. He says, I've never trusted anybody in the cabinet. I've never listened to a presidential aide. Live like a monk. Be isolated. Just read the record. Government documents its own crimes.
Newfield, who was a student in the leftist group Students for a Democratic Society when he first met Stone, said his approach comes directly out of the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, and perhaps practical necessity.
He said, well, it's partly involuntary. My hearing is so bad, I can't hear what people whisper to me at fancy cocktail parties, and I can't hear what witnesses say at congressional hearings.
But he could read. In Navasky's words, Stone was an investigative reader. He read and read to the last word of every public document, uncovering stories hiding in plain sight. Here's how Stone explained it to Bernard Kalb in a 1971 interview.
Well, I build a file, a temporary file. I read an awful lot of papers, and I try to read the record, and I try to read the hearings, and when I spot something interesting, I run downtown, ask a question, make a phone call, try to talk to people a bit, try to do some research. I try to provide fresh perspective and radical perspective and independent perspective on the news.
Of course, attending briefings, rubbing shoulders with the powerful, and using deep background sources are all useful practices. They generate the stories that fill the front page and powerful exposés, from Watergate to the horrors at Abu Ghraib. But according to Todd Gitlin of the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism, Stone's way was very different. Gitlin calls it second-order journalism, scrutinizing the reporting of others.
In other words, the sort of critical enterprise that Izzy Stone was responsible for was symbiotic with good journalism, looking for consistencies and inconsistencies, juxtaposing the claims made by different news organizations, treating the news, in short, as something other than sacred text, disassembling it.
Victor Navasky remembers how Stone worked a big story in 1957, when test ban negotiations were going on between the U.S. and Russia. The official line from the government was that the underground nuclear tests conducted in the United States would be undetectable 200 miles from the site of the blast. But Stone, reading to the last word of every dispatch, knew it just wasn't true.
He noticed in a so-called short tale, one of these little paragraphs that appears after the main story, unrelated to it, filed from the AP, not by the writer of the original story, that Geiger counters, or whatever the machinery was that picks up these tremors, were registering hundreds and thousands of miles away. So he started calling around. And then he went up to the Bureau of Standards, and he got a major scoop out of this story, which became a front-page story, because he then went back to the Defense Department, and they had to confirm that their original statement was wrong, and they changed the press release they put out, and so he not only reported news, he made news.
There was a lesson to be learned from this and many classic I.F. Stone stories, and it resonates today in the work of every journalist who Stone mentored. Jack Newfield.
Well, Izzy is the person who taught me that all governments lie.
Bernard Kalb talked to Stone about government lies when he interviewed him in 1971, after the New York Times had run with the Pentagon Papers.
Who were the liars, in your point of view?
Well, Lyndon Johnson, above all. There's just no doubt Lyndon Johnson lied to the press. They didn't need access to the White House private papers to know what every reporter in this town knows, how often Lyndon gave false impressions to us at press conference.
False impressions. Lies?
Sure, what other word is there for false impressions? I mean, if you catch a guy in front of a bank and he just robbed a vault and you say, what are you doing there? And he said, I'm waiting for a streetcar. And yes, he was waiting for a streetcar, but he just robbed the bank. He didn't tell you that part of it. Is he a liar or is he just a man who's giving you an incomplete briefing? Which is it?
Izzy's disengagement with the powerful enabled him to ask questions like that. And lately, we see the consequences of not asking. In July, the New York Times editorial page took a cold, hard look at its own pre-war coverage and concluded, quote, "We did not listen carefully to the people who disagreed with us. Our certainty flowed from the fact that such an overwhelming majority of government officials, past and present, top intelligence officials and other experts were sure that the weapons were there. We had a groupthink of our own." Just a week ago, The Washington Post gave their media reporter Howard Kurtz a page one platform to criticize their own pre-war coverage. Pentagon correspondent Thomas Ricks is quoted saying, "There was an attitude among editors, look, we're going to war. Why do we even worry about all this contrary stuff?" Here's what Stone said in 1971 about the coverage of the Vietnam War.
"I'm making a blanket indictment about Washington. This has been the best covered war we've ever in. The coverage from the field has been superb. But here in Washington, on the whole, the press crowd has been a big herd which has been committed to the government, involved in propaganda, and didn't even know it. A lot of these people, you see, they think they're being objective. They really think so. when what they're really doing is accepting the conventional wisdom, the preconceptions and premises of the government as gospel without even realizing it. A man has to come clean with his readers. You have to show where you're committed. You have to show your point of view.
Izzy held deep political convictions, but he believed most of all in full disclosure of the government and of himself. That passion fueled his reporting and sharpened his vision, allowing him to see past his colleagues on the major stories of his time. As early as 1942, he described the actions of Nazi Germany as a murder of a people so appalling that men would shudder at its horrors for centuries to come. He was ahead uncovering McCarthyism, the civil rights movement, and the Vietnam War. He reveled in the pursuit of truth. And when Jack Newfield asked him if he liked what he did, Stone said, "I have so much fun, I ought to be arrested." For On the Media, I'm Megan Ryan.
By now, you may have heard that the governor of New Jersey is gay. No, wait, I'm sorry. Test marketing shows the more palatable phrase to be, "I am a gay American." Which, of course, caught the world and the press corps off guard. Not that he was gay. If you talk to the press in New Jersey, they'll tell you, "Oh, I heard those rumors, but they were just rumors." What caught everyone off guard was that McGreevy would admit it. Now, if McGreevy had said, "I am a corrupt American," that wouldn't have caught everyone off guard. Since that announcement, we've heard details about a relationship between the governor and Golan Sepel, the Israeli national whom McGreevy picked to head New Jersey's Homeland Security Department and who's now suing McGreevy. To help us sort all this out is Bob Hennelly, the New Jersey correspondent for WNYC. Welcome to On the Media, Bob.
Hi.
Bob, do you think that mainstream news organizations, because they didn't want to out someone, wound up giving the governor a pass almost?
I think what happened was the trajectory of Golan Sepel, who, of course, has been named by anonymous sources as the individual Governor McGreevy was referring to, the fact that he had such a short tenure in state government and was out in a matter of months made the media feel that they had done their job. And so really, at that point, it became a personal matter.
The news media, you're saying, didn't force themselves to discover every aspect of why he was drummed out. The fact that he was gone was enough for them.
I think they felt, yeah, that he's out the door, and at this point, there's no reason going after it. It is a private matter. I think the media referred to Sepel as, quote, the special friend. I think that if you read the papers every day, like a good citizen, you would have come to the point of saying, this is strange.
Well, now, as you say it, they used euphemisms like special friend, which in the 50s was known to mean that it was a homosexual relationship. Are you saying the reporters who reported those stories strongly suspected that what was up was the governor was gay and doing lots of things to cover his tracks and putting out hints to that effect?
All they were trying to establish was that this relationship made no sense on the ground, that the individual's resume did not hold up to the scrutiny that was required for this very important job. And day after day, they stayed on it. They even stayed on him to the point when he went down in terms of job level, although his pay stayed the same, as a special counsel to Governor McGreevy. And then they even pursued him as he got jobs on what we call State Street, which would be, you know, the equivalent of lobbyist row in Washington, D.C. So there was an attempt to try to, within taste, I think, make the situation available to readers to at least have some perception about.
Did people ever put the question to Governor McGreevy, are you having a relationship, an affair with Golan Sepel?
I know that there was a reference in the New York Times this past week to an unidentified reporter. I put that question directly to the press secretary who was there for the last year and a half. He said that he knows of no one that on the record asked the governor that question. There are a couple of names that popped up where people said on press row, in the State House, so-and-so may have asked. I tracked it down, and they said they haven't. So we're still in pursuit of that person who would have been so pressing. There was a whole pattern of kind of corruption stories that had popped up and bad appointments that were there as part of the background for this story. So I think to some degree, one might say that Governor McGreevy has really had a new innovation where coming out was the most brilliant stroke of genius that you can imagine, because it totally dazzled the national media, which went for the question of his sexuality, which, of course, is what they're trained to do.
But to what effect? How did it wind up helping McGreevy? Can it salvage his political career?
Not salvage, but certainly give him a controlled exit. And that's the thing. He has said that he is going to have a transfer of power that will end on November 15th. Well, that's, you know, some 90 days to transfer power. Well, the federal government has a transfer of power that's 80 days, and that's the last standing superpower. So it appears he's hanging in there. I think what's interesting is that just a few days after this disclosure, Governor McGreevy's major campaign giver, Charles Kushner, a major developer and giver to the Democratic Party nationally, was convicted of multiple counts of income tax evasion, tampering with witnesses, and he'll probably get 2 years in jail. So in essence, he's taken control of the media agenda. So now the likes of Oprah and Barbara Walters want to talk with him about his sexuality.
Well, thank you very much, Bob.
Hey, thanks, Mike.
Bob Henley is New Jersey correspondent for public radio station WNYC, which also produces this program. Up next, how to mislead without lying, how John Kerry would change the direction of the FCC, and detente between India and Pakistan leads to a meeting of the musicals. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Mike Pesca. George W. Bush may indeed be the first president since Herbert Hoover to preside over a net job loss, but one industry has boomed under his watch. People whose job it is to vet the words of politicians. The George W. Bush era is clearly the golden age of presidential vetting. At the age of 26, Brian Kiefer is already a veteran vetter. He and his two partners run the website spinsanity.com, and they've all now written a new book called All the President's Spin. Brian, welcome to OTM.
Thank you very much for having me on.
I'm looking at the cover of your book, and there's a picture of George Bush crossing his fingers, but you never use lie in the title of his book. So what exactly are you accusing the Bush administration of doing?
Well, they're not really liars. You know, in the book, I think we document two or three places where they've said something that they knew was untrue. What we found was that they were very sophisticated misleaders in the sense that they'll say things that are half true or partially true, or there's a little grain of truth. And because they don't lie outright, the media very rarely calls them on it.
And so what are the ones that are just outright lies?
George W. Bush would stand up after September 11th and say, during the campaign, I said in Chicago to the American people that only under three circumstances would I run a deficit, under war, recession, or national emergency. And I never imagined we'd hit the trifecta. And it was his way of sort of defending himself from blame for the budget deficit, which was growing and has grown since. And there's no record anywhere that he ever said anything like that during the campaign. White House reporters couldn't come up with it. The White House couldn't come up with it themselves. And so really, it just didn't happen.
So when you think he says these things that are lies, is that the real slip up? Because usually he's disciplined enough to go right up to the truth but not cross it?
Karen Hughes writes in her book, my first rule is you don't tell a lie, because the media will call you if you lie, but they won't do it if you say something that's really heavily spun but may have a grain of truth to it.
But I've seen so many stories comparing the things that the Bush administration said linking Saddam Hussein to September 11th. It got played in the media as these were purposefully misleading statements. So did the fact that they didn't maybe commit the dictionary definition of lie really get them off the hook in that case?
Well, you know, it got them off the hook before the war. What they really did is they exaggerated the certainty of what they knew. They would say, we know Saddam has weapons of mass destruction, when the intelligence reports really didn't tell them that. They told them, well, probably, but probably doesn't sound very good in a soundbite. And so what they did is they really presented it as certain when it just wasn't certain at all.
Now, the website, which I go to a lot, Spinsanity, it basically vets everyone. It does it for Bush. It does it for Kerry. It does it for media figures like Bill O'Reilly and Michael Moore. But this book is all the president's spin, and everything we've been talking about so far is about how the president lied. There's a long history of presidents perhaps embellishing the truth. So how come you're saying it's so unprecedented with Bush?
Well, what they've done is they've taken what's sort of normal for presidents under fire, under scandal, or during a campaign, and made that their day-to-day MO in the way they govern the country and the way they present their policies. They've made this sort of image creation that Reagan was so good at, the 24/7, you know, nonstop rapid response that Clinton was very good at under fire, combined it with these misleading public relations tactics, and really taken this to an entire another level.
If this book were just about the campaign and all the ads that people see, have there been more lies coming out of the Bush side than the Kerry side, in your estimation?
I would say Bush has been a little bit more aggressive, but there's plenty of spin to go around here. And Kerry has really adopted the tactics that Bush has pioneered in the White House, picked up on that, and really run with them this campaign season.
In the interest of fairness, give me a good example of a Kerry whopper.
Sure. Well, he said 3 million jobs have been lost under Bush. It's a classic example of taking a number and stripping it out of context, because that's the number for the private sector, or they say manufacturing jobs sometimes. But Kerry has gone out and said, that's the overall number. You know, 3 million jobs have been lost, when really the number is down to about 1.1. There's still a net loss, but it's not nearly as large as Kerry has said it is.
The most cynical part of me says, you know what, he put that misleading figure out so that the correction stories would also reflect poorly on George Bush.
Right, but it's amazing to watch the press try and cover this. The AP, even after getting the number correct, let Kerry continue to spin them, printed it as if it were a fact without any sort of contradiction for weeks after Kerry started saying it.
One thing that I see is that people who have a horse in the race either way, they want the media to be more outraged by either Kerry's lies or Bush's lies, but they can't hammer it, because if one side lies more and then the media is always pointing it out, it really makes it seem like they're rooting for the other side.
Well, the media has interpreted objectivity to often mean artificial balance. So what happens is when Bush says something like, the average tax cut was $1,500, the media will print that, and then if they're going to contradict it, they'll go to some outside expert, or maybe they'll go to the opposite campaign saying, no, it wasn't $1,500. The average tax cut for people in the middle income bracket was a few hundred. But the problem is that when it's he said, she said, the readers don't really get a sense of who's right and who's wrong.
But in the major papers of America, I see an effort to run features that they might call an ad watch or an ad check, where they tell you who's lying. And as someone who's reported on campaigns, there's nothing we reporters like more than catching anyone in a lie.
I mean, ad watch pieces are wonderful as far as they go. But the problem is they're out of the news cycle. And when Bush says Kerry voted 350 times for higher taxes, eventually they do an ad watch piece and an op-ed kind of piece. And finally, it finds its way into the news coverage a month later. And so the problem for readers is that they hear the misleading soundbite long before they hear it debunked. You know, the Annenberg Public Policy Center did a survey of voters in swing states in particular, asking them about the claims that had been in ads, like the 350 votes for higher taxes, and they found that people believed them for the most part.
The interesting thing about that survey is that people said, you know, I don't believe these ads. I know to take them with a grain of salt. But then when they say, well, what about 350 votes? They say, oh, well, that's a fact.
Right, right.
If George Bush wins this election, it will seem to him and his advisors that these tactics have been validated. Paint me the picture. How will this all change if John Kerry wins the election?
I mean, the scary part is it may not change if John Kerry wins the election. You know, the incentive for politicians is if you can game the system and if you can get better coverage or less critical coverage than you probably deserve, go for it.
Thanks very much, Brian.
Hey, thanks very much for having me.
Brian Kiefer, author of All the President's Spin, a Spinsanity.com production. The media issues discussed by Bush and Kerry so far in the campaign have been limited to who reads more newspapers and whose ads are meaner. But recently, John Kerry said he'd like to shake things up at the FCC. Here's what he told the Unity Convention of Minority Journalists in Washington, D.C. last month.
I'm against the ongoing push for media consolidation. I was in favor of the rollback. I voted against the expansion. And as president, as I said, I will appoint people to the FCC, and I will pursue a policy that tries to have as diverse and broad an ownership as possible.
Mark Fitzgerald has written about Kerry's media policy for Editor and Publisher magazine. Fitzgerald says the kinds of changes Kerry mentioned are quite doable.
All he is really talking about is turning back the clock literally a few months. And there's legislation both before Congress, and of course there was recently a federal court decision that told the FCC to go back and look at how they rewrote the rules again.
So for all the things the president can't do if the other party controls the House and the Senate, some of these FCC regulations are something that Kerry can do. Why? Does he immediately appoint new commissioners? How does the FCC board work?
The FCC has five members. The party in power has an appointment of three. And the chairman, who's Michael Powell right now, a Republican, would, if following tradition, resign as soon as Kerry took office. And Kerry would be able to appoint a chairman and another Democrat to have three Democrats.
Do you have any idea about who or even what type of commissioners Kerry would be looking for as an FCC appointee?
Well, he told the people at Unity that what he wanted was somebody that would be way more activist than we've seen on content in broadcasting. There's been a lot of attention, of course, to the Howard Stern situation here in Chicago, Mancow Mueller. But in actual fact, the FCC has really not been too concerned with indecency. And this is something that both of the Democrats on the FCC have really tried to change. It's one reason that they've been so successful in forming this coalition of people from Right to Life and NRA and social conservatives, right up to Michael Moore sorts of people, MoveOn.org, some of the media organizations that we're beginning to see.
How would the change in the FCC board, assuming that it became 3-2 Democrat instead of 3-2 Republican, how might that result in a change that we'd actually see in our media?
You'd see it, I think, almost right away. A good example is John Kerry has declared that he would like cable companies to be forced to price their options by each channel. You typically get big packages, and these packages are made in various ways. You'd be able to say, well, I don't want the Golf Channel, and I'm not going to pay for it. I don't want A&E, and I'm not going to pay for it.
Now, when the FCC tried a little deregulation last year, a surprisingly bipartisan coalition rose up against it. And also surprising was the fact that the public woke up and noticed what was going on. I think that did surprise President Bush a little. So if there was this groundswell of opposition to media deregulation, and if Kerry stands on the other side of the issue, why don't you think this has become a big election issue, that Kerry has a stance that the people seem to like more than Bush's stance on the issue of media deregulation?
That's a very interesting question. At Unity, John Kerry answered this only in answer to a question. He didn't bring this up as part of his speech. But I would say this. John Edwards actually spoke about this quite a bit during his own campaign. He has been more forward on this issue than John Kerry was.
And do you think that part of the reason why he raised it, as you said, in response to a direct question, but hasn't made it a big campaign issue, has to do with the fact that he does have to do some massaging with the actual media companies who will probably oppose what he's talking about? Maybe it has something to do with the fact that he's hoping for some good coverage from now until Election Day.
Yeah, I think that as we've seen, what happens with the media is that they don't necessarily punish somebody like this for bringing these things up. They simply don't bring it up themselves. The media has done a terrible, terrible job in telling American people what was at issue here in 2003. In February of 2003, about 4 months before the actual decisions were to be made, a Pew poll found that 73% of Americans had no idea that there was going to be changes in who could own their local TV stations, whether their local newspaper could own their local radio station. And that is absolutely the fault of the media, because it just simply wasn't covered.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Mark Fitzgerald, editor-at-large for Editor and Publisher. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Several months ago, OTM reported on a war movie from India, Line of Control. The film flopped. Part of the reason was that the anti-Pakistan bias in the film didn't sit well with audiences at a time when relations between India and Pakistan are actually improving. In the last few months, a stream of Pakistani film stars, musicians, and directors have been hopping over to Mumbai, the center of India's film industry. But it's not just the desire for good relations between the nuclear neighbors that's bringing Pakistani artists across the border. It's also the knowledge that the Pakistani film industry, dubbed Lollywood because of its base in the city of Lahore, is dying, if not already dead. Miranda Kennedy reports from Lahore on Pakistan's hopes for bringing its cinema back to life.
Meera is one of Lollywood's highest-paid actresses. At the wise old age of 24, she's already made almost 60 Lollywood films. This one is a love story with some 10 song and dance numbers. The lip-syncing is off and the color is bad, but Meera manages to execute some very sexy love scenes while fully clothed. Mira's just started working on her first Bollywood production, which she's shooting in Bombay with Indian director Mahesh Bhatt.
I just want to contribute to Pakistan and India for the betterment and for the peace. We are together. I don't want to belong to one industry. I just want to do an international work and to want to recognize as in Pakistani actress, India and Hollywood, everywhere.
Mira certainly won't get the international recognition she longs for by acting in Pakistani films. Lollywood only produces about 40 films a year, and it has no international audience. In the last decade, more than 1,000 movie theaters have closed down in Pakistan. Still, in some areas, the streets are hung with hand-drawn movie posters, usually featuring women with big bosoms and blood dripping from their mouths. Moviegoing is now restricted to men of the lower classes in city centers. Everyone else watches pirated DVDs of well-made Bollywood films in the safety and comfort of their own homes. They might as well, since the only things that differentiate Pakistani from Indian films these days is that they're not as well made, and because of Pakistani censor board rules, they don't show drinking or nudity.
The boats are catering for masses.
Faizan Pirzada is a Lahore-based filmmaker.
Whether it's love or action, it's done the same way. The only difference that I see in Bollywood films is that they have more funds. They spend more money, they have better equipment, and they have been supporting an academy, so they get some training. They're able to make a good-looking film. Out here in Pakistan, the film industry had been left on its own.
Before India's partition in 1947, both Bombay and Lahore were centers of Indian cinema. After Pakistan's creation, Lahore's film industry struggled to distinguish itself from Bombay's. But in the 60s and 70s, Pakistan's Islamist leaders began actively discouraging cinema. Military dictator Zia-ul-Haq forced most Lahore studios to close down. Lollywood has never recovered. To film producer Shahzad Ghul, it's a tragedy that Pakistani film hasn't succeeded in developing an identity of its own, unlike, say, Iranian cinema, which developed a distinctive voice under an oppressive political regime.
I think cinema is an identity of a country. It's a roaming ambassador of a country, which today Pakistan does not have.
Shahzad's father founded Evernew Film Studios before partition, which soon became one of Pakistan's top studios. But in the last decade, in order to survive, Shahzad has had to turn to TV production. He's not alone. His industry colleagues now do everything from advertising soap to running a circus to make money.
We consider ourselves filmmakers, but the existing situation has really forced us to just wait and see what is in the offing, and we are very desperately wanting to open trade with India. I personally feel it's the only savior for Pakistani cinema today.
In 1962, the Pakistan Film Producers Association asked the government to ban Indian films in Pakistan, which they were only too happy to do. Now, some 40 years later, the association has just asked Pakistan to repeal the ban. They say Pakistani theaters can't stay afloat by showing third-rate Pakistani films. They want to make it legal to screen Indian films and to co-produce films with Bollywood. But now all Lollywood can do is wait for the Pakistani government to make up its mind. Here on Lahore's Hall Road, you can find pirated software for 30 cents and DVDs of Bollywood films for not much more. The very day of a Lollywood release, a pirated copy of the film will run on one of Pakistan's domestic cable channels. Piracy has delivered another crushing blow to Pakistan's whimpering film industry. Now it's up to its old enemy, India, to save it. Now that sounds like the makings of a good Bollywood film. For On the Media, I'm Miranda Kennedy in Lahore.
And that's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katia Rogers and produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, and Derek John. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Ann Kossoff and Mike Vuolo and editing help from Sharon Ball. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Arun Roth is senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist/composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. Brooke Gladstone is managing editor when she's not on vacation. Bob Garfield is still on vacation, even when he's not on vacation. Both of them will be back here next week, and they'll be joined by special guest star Agnes Moorehead as Andorra. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Mike Pesca.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. And the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.